Night on the Banks.
Each fortnight along the banks of the River Raritan, folk from near and far gather as the round table is convened to discuss matters of concern which range from the heart of Queen's campus to the far corners of the globe. Now, as all is called to order, we give you the host of Night on the Banks, Stuart Knarr.
Hello and welcome to Night on the Banks. Tonight we conclude what has been a periodic process over the past 2 years, bringing the history of Rutgers up to date. And once again, I'm honored to have with me in the studio as my guest, Dr. Richard McCormick, Dean of Rutgers College, University Historian, Professor of History, and Rutgers alumnus. And Dr. McCormick, welcome back.
Thank you, Stu.
We ended last time with the outbreak of the Second World War, and at that point, after a period of severe depression, what condition was Rutgers, an institution already perennially plagued by lack of finances, now in?
Well, the war was a disaster for Rutgers. To put it very briefly, by 1943, there were virtually no civilian students left, just a couple of hundred. Most of the faculty had left, and the only thing that kept some semblance of the university going was the presence here of substantial military contingents, the Army Specialized Training Program, and certain other units, but in effect, the civilian operation of the university ceased during the war, and it was turned into a unit serving the needs of the military.
Well, even during the war, even though we had such a visible enemy, you could say, in World War II, as compared to maybe later wars like Vietnam, which there was much greater outcry over, there was really not a standard opinion on campus as to the role the United States should take in the war, was it? It wasn't a unanimous stand, was it?
Not prior to December 7th, 1941. After December 7th, 1941, there was very little in the way of negative reactions to American involvement. It was not a subject of controversy. It had been, of course, during 1940 and 41.
You already said that veterans now were the greatest number of students here at Rutgers. And during the war, there were also some other changes, weren't there? Like schedule changes, a three-year graduation, I think, was implemented, and a four-term semester, so people could be processed through more rapidly. I guess that would be the reason for doing that.
Yes, but as I say, by the middle of 43, there was just a tiny remnant of civilian students left. Virtually all of them had either gone into the military services or into war work, so that it was a very strange kind of university. Then, of course, in 1945, a period of extraordinary change and development began. First of all, in 1945, as a result of new legislation, Rutgers was finally designated as the State University of New Jersey. As an instrumentality of the state to be used for the purpose of providing higher education. And at the time, at least, it was felt that this opened up large new opportunities for Rutgers. It was anticipated that with this designation as the state university, there would be not only substantial increases in students, but along with that, substantial increases in funding. Secondly, of course, with the end of the war, there was the tremendous influx of veterans into the university. Rutgers College, for example, had never enrolled more than about 1,700 students before the war. By 1948, we had 4,200 students. And regrettably, those 4,200 students had somehow to be squeezed into essentially the same facilities that had previously been less than adequate for 1,700 students. This was an unprecedented and very, very sudden growth. The only way it could be handled was by going out and hiring faculty by the dozens, so to speak, tremendous expansion in the teaching staff. And in order to provide physical facilities, we were forced to go out and find temporary buildings that could be erected. Records Hall was one of them. Originally, that was brought here to serve as a dining hall for the large numbers of students who came in after the war. And then we had a large number of temporary classrooms, little iron shacks stretched along the riverbank where the river dorms are now and other places. So it called for tremendous improvisation and a large commitment on the part of the university to serve the needs of these returning veterans.
You know, we usually think of war, I guess, in terms of manpower lost or manpower that leaves the university, and we mentioned the increase in the number of students at Rutgers College. What about the College for Women? How did the war affect?
Much less, of course. The enrollments there remained essentially stable because obviously women were not being drafted in World War II. So that that unit of the university was far less affected than any others.
You mentioned expansion, and not only did the university need to expand with building new buildings here in New Brunswick, it also began to expand into other areas. Like, I think one of the first new components was an already existing institution in Newark, wasn't
Yes,
it?
In 1946, following a year of negotiations, what we now know as the Newark units of Rutgers joined the university. Originally, there was the College of Arts and Sciences, the School of Law, the School of Business, and earlier, back in 1927, of course, the College of Pharmacy in Newark had become associated with the university. Moreover, in addition to the expansion in Newark, in order to accommodate veterans, so-called off-campus centers were established all over the state, in Jersey City, Atlantic City, Patterson, and so on, because it was impossible to accommodate all of the students who wanted to get in, and yet the university felt an obligation, particularly as a state university, to meet their needs. And this was done essentially through these off-campus centers.
Do the off-campus centers, say, in Patterson and Jersey City, have anything to do with the state colleges that are there today? Did they grow or anything,
no.
Or were they totally unassociated?
No, these were not directly associated with the state colleges.
Just to give our listeners some idea of the expansion, and well, let's limit it to here in the New Brunswick area, the four New Brunswick campuses, can you describe briefly just the kind of growth, maybe just geographically, what areas have been built since the war? Because it is a fantastic growth, and I think some people probably don't know how many buildings were built just since the war.
Well, the growth came in phases, actually down until 1959, when for the first time a bond issue was approved by the voters of the state to provide substantial funds for the state university. Growth was very, very slow. Between the end of the war in 1959, consisted essentially of the construction of the Institute of Microbiology, the Wright Laboratories for Chemistry, the Demarest Dormitory, the River Dorms. These were some of the major facilities associated with Rutgers College, particularly, that came into existence in those years. But then, during the 60s, we entered into our period of very large growth. Basically, it was in the 1960s that the whole Bush campus began to take shape, with the construction of the of Nelson Hall for biology, and then subsequently the physics building, the Hill Center, College of Engineering, and most recently the building for psychology. But most of those buildings and much of the other development of Bush dates essentially from 1959.
You mentioned microbiology before, and that brings to mind that research has always been a very, very important part of the university, and that was really demonstrated probably at a greater degree than really no other time after the war there, wasn't it, by a man who eventually won a Nobel Prize for what he discovered.
Well, research has not always been a part of the university. There was very, very little research activity on the part of members of the faculty of the university before 1945.
Oh.
prior to World War II, this university granted about a dozen or 15 doctorates a year. Now, this year, we'll be granting over 300. So that one of the great developments that takes place after 1945 is the building up of the graduate school and the development of a research-oriented faculty. There were conspicuous exceptions. One of those, of course, was Selman Waksman, who was to be honored with a Nobel Prize for his work in the discovery of streptomycin. And, of course, one of the great monuments to his achievements is the Waksman Institute of Microbiology.
From the 1700s, when we really started talking about Queen's College, and then we've moved into the 1800s, and we saw some changes in curriculum. It started out being very, very rigid. As we get into the 1940s and the 1950s, how does it change? And it's really come a long way by that point from the original Queen's College curriculum, but what does it look like then, just two decades ago?
Well, the major changes in the curriculum actually took place essentially between 1916 and 1927. And if one were to go back and look at college catalogs in the 1920s, they wouldn't look too different. That is, the shape of the curriculum wouldn't look too different from what it does today. On the other hand, if one were to go back to 1900, let us say, the curriculum would look very, very strange indeed. In 1945, Rutgers College followed the lead, if you will, of Harvard, which had recently, at that time, produced a very famous report on general education and adopted the philosophy of distribution requirements. And that pattern of distribution requirements continued essentially unchanged down until 1969, when in the context of those years of the late 1960s, rather substantial changes were made in the curriculum, essentially in the direction of providing at a greater degree of freedom or of choice or of permissiveness to students in devising their curricula. Now, last year, as a result of actions by the Rutgers College faculty, somewhat more structure has been restored to the curriculum through the institution of what we now call our major, minor, mini arrangement.
We looked at a time back at during the war when activities really, for all intents and purposes, were just about canceled. There weren't very many extracurricular activities. Now we're getting into a decade, the 50s, where we think of students kind of as being quiet, or we call it the fabulous 50s, or maybe we call it the not-so-fabulous 50s. But in terms of activities, in the late 40s, there was one activity that made it possible for us to broadcast this very program, which began WRSU. What other types of activities were begun around the university after the war?
Well, the first problem was to reestablish activities that had been totally demolished by the war. Targum went out of existence. Most of the fraternities went out of existence. Virtually every, even intercollegiate athletics went out of existence. So after the war, the first concern was to reestablish the fraternities, Targum, intercollegiate athletics, and so on. And this was really quite a remarkable feat. And by, say, 1947, 48, the campus had made a rather remarkable return to an appearance of normality. In time, of course, there were to be changes in the patterns of student interest. One of them was reflected, of course, in the, as you pointed out, in the emergence of WRSU, which started out very humbly and which, of course, is now an organization of great importance, not only to this college, but to the university and the community beyond. Then other kinds of changes took place. For example, down to the 1950s, the formal dances that had constituted the high points of the social year ever since the 1890s began to fade out. And there was an interesting transition that took place in the late 50s as dances were transformed into concerts. And then, by the early 60s, there was no longer any pretense of a dance. It became strictly a concert. There were other changes of this kind that reflected changing student attitudes, more fundamental changes perhaps in society.
We haven't yet really mentioned too many personalities around the university yet this evening, but in 1951, Rutgers got a new president when Dr. Clothier retired, and the end of the Clothier presidency really kind of marks a sort of a milestone, doesn't it? Especially in terms of years, at least, served.
Well, Dr. Clothier was president for 20 years. We had had two earlier presidents, Dr. Campbell and Dr. Demarest, who served for comparable periods. It is growing increasingly uncommon, of course, today to find people who can survive for 20 years in those positions. But Dr. Clothier was a very remarkable man, a man of great personal character and integrity, who had the misfortune, in a sense, of assuming the presidency of the university in the depths of the Depression. And then just as things began to look a little better, came the devastating experience of World War II. And then immediately following the war, he had somehow to contend with this enormous expansion of the university, occasioned by the returning veterans. And then as his administration drew to a close, he had to confront, if you will, the disappointment of the failure of the state to supply to the university resources commensurate with the obligations that we had assumed as the state university. So his was both a long and a very difficult administration.
And of course he left during another war. The war in Korea
just
had
begun.
And I imagine that left many men in Rutgers wondering about their future, but even more so, as a college student, looking ahead just a few more years from that time, I often wonder how a movement like McCarthyism in the 50s affected the freedom of thought and expression, which really seems so essential to a college community. And not having exactly lived through it or being too young to remember it, it looks to me as a movement that really made people afraid to really speak their minds.
Well, McCarthy, of course, was simply one element, the most conspicuous element in that period of fear and anxiety and suppression. Richard Nixon, if you will, was another element. Nixon, you'll recall, gained his first fame in connection with the prosecution of Alger Hiss. But even more broadly, you have to understand that this was the period of the so-called Cold War, when we were terribly concerned, one might even say paranoid, about the communist menace. The communist menace is represented, of course, most directly by Russia, but anything that could be labeled as communist aroused these terrifying concerns. Now, it was McCarthy, of course, who was able to verbalize the magnitude of the communist threat and so on. But even if there had been no Joseph McCarthy, this was still a period when anything that could be labeled communist or pink or even liberal could be equated virtually with treason. So that individuals felt under severe constraints in expressing opinions, not only on campuses, but also in the media, people in radio, in the movies, in the newspapers. Anyone who was in a position to express opinions was subject to possible blacklisting or prosecution if those opinions offended the mass of the people who were so terribly concerned about the menace of communism.
Was there something called the anti-subversive oath that had to be taken by the faculty at that time?
Not really. We have always had members of this faculty have, both before and since, have as a condition of employment, had to take an oath to support and uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of New Jersey. No, far more terrifying, of course, were the inquisitions of certain congressional committees and the exposure that they gave to what they called, at least, subversives. Certainly heightened the sense of intimidation within the intellectual community.
In 1945, you had mentioned that the university takes on a new role as an instrumentality of the state. And in 1956, there's another change. And how does that change compare with the 45 change?
Under the change that took place in 1945, Rutgers continued to enjoy a very considerable degree of autonomy under its Board of Trustees. The Board of Trustees was predominantly a self-perpetuating group, although there were on the board public representatives. The people of New Jersey and their political representatives obviously did not feel that Rutgers was truly the state university, so long as it was managed by a board of trustees that was widely regarded as a private group. This became increasingly apparent in the 1950s as state support dwindled instead of increasing for the university. And so it was made clear to the university by Governor Minor in particular, although earlier governors had also, oh, there was the same message, that if Rutgers was to be regarded truly as the State University of New Jersey, it would have to be placed under a different kind of management. And the result was, after considerable study by a committee of the Board of Trustees, the enactment of legislation in 1956, creating a new governing board for the university, the Board of Governors, a majority of whose members are appointed by the governor of New Jersey, a minority appointed by the Board of Trustees. Now, essentially the whole purpose of that legislation was to establish the fact that this was a state university under public control. And I must say that it had the desired effect that after the establishment of the Board of Governors, there was heightened confidence in Rutgers as a state university. Appropriations rose, and most importantly, in 1959, the people of New Jersey went to the polls and for the first time approved a very, very substantial bond issue, which, for example, led to the construction of Scott Hall and the Bishop dormitories and a great many other facilities at Bush, and really marked a breakthrough. This was the first time that we could really have the feeling that we enjoyed the confidence and support of the people of the state. And although I know we do not feel that our state support is adequate, also, we feel very restive at times about the degree of control exercised over the university by the state. Personally, I have no doubts whatsoever that we moved in the right direction in 1956 when this action of establishing the Board of Governors was taken.
Not having a lot of time left, I'd like to ask you kind of a philosophical type of question about education in general. In the 50s, students were described at least once, probably more than once, as a generation without a cause. In the 60s, they got their cause or causes, multiple. And in 1977, while we're sitting here, things seem not again not silent, but much quieter. Were the 60s an aberration, do you think, or did some kind of lasting change take place in American higher education?
I wouldn't put the question quite that way. I think changes took place in the 1960s that far transcended higher education. That is, a whole new lifestyle was adopted by young people. And
these
pressed me to define what I mean by young. But it was a new style. We are still, of course, trying to describe exactly what that style represented. It represented certainly rebellion against many traditional values, against many traditional attitudes. And I believe that many of the basic elements of that lifestyle persist today. Now, this affected, among other things, higher education. But it affected higher education particularly because that's where the young people were. But it is much broader than something that happened within the universities. And it's no doubt going to take a long time to puzzle out just why. Now, the causes of the 60s were highly political causes, the war in Vietnam, civil rights, and so on. The causes of today are, in a sense, somewhat less political, although, of course, they do have their political overtones. But on the campus this year, although we say there's been a great deal of apathy, there has been intense concern manifest at different points of the year with the issue of pornography, with the issue of abortion, with the issue of homosexuality. Now, these are not the same issues that achieved prominence in the 1960s, but they do represent a continuation, if you will, of attempts to redefine the roles of individuals in society and the relationships of individuals and groups to one another. It's a more personal kind of thing than the, let's say, the Vietnam War, but nevertheless represents, in my view at least, a continuation of certain thrusts and concerns that we saw emerging in the 1960s.
Dr. McCormick, we only have a few seconds left, so let me take the chance to ask you, you're stepping down now after 3 years as Dean of Rutgers College. What's in store for Dr. Richard McCormick?
Well, I will be engaged in teaching. In particular, I hope to continue teaching my course, History 201, Development of the United States. The next year, I'm going to plan to spend a lot of time in the library. I've been away from the books pretty much for 3 years, and it's time to go back and recharge the wells. And over the next several years, I have in mind at least 3 books that I would like to be able to write.
Dr. McCormick, once again, all too rapidly we've run out of time. I want to thank you for coming again to the show today and for appearing time and time again over the past 2 years to describe what's a fascinating and, I guess, hopefully never-ending story of Rutgers. It's been a lot of fun. And let me also take the opportunity to wish you the best of luck in everything that you do in the future. And let me add personally that in light of and understanding your decision to serve as dean for 3 years, I personally feel honored to have been a student here while you've been dean. So thank you from me.
Thank you, Stu.
My thanks also to engineer Mike Blishak for his technical supervision. And most of all, as the final seconds tick away in this program, as well as the Night on the Banks series, my appreciation goes to you, the listener, for tuning in. Whether you've been a night regular for the past 2 years or you're hearing us tonight for the first time, I hope that you've gotten some of the enjoyment that I have as we've convened the roundtable each fortnight to conduct the interviews, discussions, and debates concerning the issues that shape Rutgers and the world. So for Night on the Banks, I'm Stuart Narr bidding you a fond farewell from the banks of the old Raritan.